It was almost real, the Pro Wrestling History Podcast, episode 51. Hello and welcome to this episode of It Was Almost Real, the Pro Wrestling History Podcast. My name is Ken Zimmerman Jr. and this is the podcast dedicated to the history of professional wrestling between 1870 and 1920, although we sometimes stretch into the 1930s. And in this episode, I'll be discussing the threat that Marin Plastina posed to the Wrestling Trust between 1917 and 1921. This podcast episode is the result of my research for the book I'm writing on John the Nebraska Tiger Man Pesek, who settled several promotional wars in the 1920s in legitimate contests. But first, I'll give a little update. This episode is going to be a solo episode. I'm not joined by Dan or my sons. And also, next week's episode, I originally planned to be a solo episode because I've not been enamored with the episodes we produced on Skype since Dan has been sick. We will walk over each other sometimes when we are in the studio, but we can all see each other and we can get the visual clues and everything. Well, because the Zimmermans tend to be hard-headed, difficult to lead, besides the fact that no one wants to leave their camera on other than me, so I don't get the visual cues from the other, and let's give Dan a little bit of a break. There's a reason he doesn't want to have his camera on, because he has no idea who's going to walk into his room to check on him or bring him his medicine. Because I cannot see the physical or the visual clues from the other co-hosts, we are having a tendency to walk on each other a lot more than we normally do. No, the other issue is no one remembers to mute their mic when somebody walks in and starts talking to them, or because we're not in the ideal recording setting and people traipse through where I'm at, making a lot of noise despite the fact that I say that, hey, this microphone picks up just about everything. I have to spend a lot of time post-editing the episodes we've been doing. A lot of times when we're in the million-dollar studio, all I do is, as long as nobody's had their potty mouth going that episode, normally I'll just tack on the musical outro at the end of it and I put it up. There's not very much post-production that goes into it. I'm probably spending about 2 hours post-producing these last couple Skype episodes. So I was originally only going to do 2 solo episodes. Dan will be home in another week, and we were just going to start doing our normal podcast from there again. However, Dan is constantly asking me about the schedule for the podcast, and I know how much he loves doing them, and I think it's really good for his mindset. So this episode is going to be posted on April Fool's Day. I'm actually recording it on Easter Sunday morning, March 31st. And then tomorrow night, we're going to get a ship of fools together to record on April Fool's Day. That episode will come out on April 8th. April 15th will be our break week. And then April 22nd, we should be back in the Million Dollar Studio. So everything should be the normal experience you're used to listening to since Dan and I started doing the podcast together, joined by my sons occasionally. Well, actually, I guess Caleb and I, my youngest son, started doing them together, but then Dan became my regular co-host in early 2023-ish. Since then, it's been primarily me and Dan, joined by my sons occasionally. And I'm going to spend a lot of time on the news with tomorrow's episode. So I'm not going to spend a ton of time on the news with this update. And I was going to spare you a rant, but lucky you, my phone and my Garmin have been going off like a demented cuckoo clock for the last hour. To say I'm a member of a large family would be a big understatement. So I'm part of a blended family. My mom married my stepfather when I was 12 years old. And his 5 daughters are my 5 older sisters. The 8 of us are one family, and we consider our stepfather our dad. He raised me and my 2 younger sisters. And so the 8 of us, we don't never refer to each other as stepbrother and stepsister. We're just brothers, one brother, me, and 7 sisters. And out of those 8 kids, we produced 26 grandchildren who have produced and I've started to lose count on this, I think 17 great-grandchildren at this point. And then my great-niece is pregnant now, so we will pretty soon have 5 great-grandchildren. I'm sorry, great-great-grandchildren. So when Mom and Dad were both alive, there was 5 generations alive at that time. I think when you add in spouses and everyone else, when Solomon, my oldest grandson, was born, my sister Vicky and my mom estimated that the family was 80 members large at that time. And there have been at least 5 or 6 births since then. So on average, we average about a birth every 18 months. And we've had 2 deaths, unfortunately. My mom and my oldest sister Vicky both passed away. My mom in 2019 and my sister Vicky in 2022. And if you've listened to the podcast at all, you know my sister Vicky is a big reason why I became a wrestling fan. I was watching when my mom and dad got married. And my sister Vicky was a huge wrestling fan, but nobody else in the family would go with her. When she found out that I watched wrestling, she asked me if I would go with her because she had season tickets, but didn't go because nobody would go with her. So every 3 weeks on a Friday, she was 27 years old, I was 12, she would come pick me up, and we would go to the wrestling match together. And that went on for 3 or 4 years before we got kind of tired of the St. Louis product. Because when Sam Muchnick retired, it drastically changed. So my sister Vicky is a big reason for why I became a wrestling fan in the first place and had the interest of researching when wrestling was legitimate. And as I've said before, while many of the matches in the 19th century and a lot of the matches, well, a lot's probably pushing it. While most of the matches of the 19th century and many of the matches of the first 15 years of the 20th century were contests, they worked matches for as long as I've researched. So I've researched back into the 1870s. There have been worked matches going back to the 1870s. But getting back to the family. So we have an extremely large family. So every time the holidays come up, everybody has to get on their phones and group text out as many people in the family as you can. And I have asked everybody at least a dozen times, please do not include me on group text because I will not bow my knee to the evil empire. My Samsung only allows me to reply to messages with 9 people or less. And all of the group texts that go out in our family, and because most of them have iPhones, are a lot more than 9 people. So I can't even respond to say, dear God, take me out of this text thing. I just have to sit here while, and maybe there's a way around it, but I don't care enough to do the research to figure that out. I've got other stuff that I want to research and work on, not try to figure out how to get out of group texts on my phone. And of course, this morning, it's Easter morning, so my baby sister, who loves me enough not to put me in a group text, sends me an individual happy Easter, but then everybody else includes me in all these group texts. So my phone has been going off like a demented alarm clock, and I have a Garmin which tracks all the things I really care about: my heart rate, my stress levels, my sleep, things like that. And it keeps going off. So now I normally charge it every night while I'm winding down from the day. Now I'm going to have to charge it at midday so I don't lose all my charge because this thing's going off constantly with Happy Easter. Oh, have you seen this? Oh, this is wonderful. So my message is, please, for the love of God, keep people out of the group text. If you put somebody in a group text, make sure that they really want to be in that group text. I personally would not allow anybody to create a text group larger than 4 or 5 people because once you get past that, it's too unwieldy anyway. Of course, they're not trying to decide anything. They're just trying to drive everybody crazy with, hey, oh, this is great. Oh, look at my dog. Hey, this is wonderful. Yeah, we love you. I get it. But please, for the sake of everything that's great, keep people out of group texts. So you did get a mini rant that you probably weren't anticipating this morning, but things are as they are. And the only wrestling... Well, I didn't give an update. So the book's timeline has not changed. The book on Chief Desmond should be out probably about the end of April. I'm about 20,000 words in, and I foresee that book being, well, it could be as many as 40,000 words, but it depends just how much I decide to include. And then the Pesek book is still looking at a June, July. I really want to get it out before mid-July, because I am very, very busy from mid-July until the end of September with my primary employment, which I love and will always do. So this is probably going to always be the case from here on out. So I'm probably going to take off. If I get that book done, I will obviously be researching, because I read and research during lunch every day pretty much. But I don't know if I'll start a new project until the beginning of October. So we're probably looking at Pesek coming out in July, and then maybe the next book coming out in November or December. It depends on if I get any writing done during that very busy 2.5 month period. But the one thing I did want to update wise, I guess I could have covered this in the review too, but I've also got something I want to talk about in the review that I found that's much more historical. I had been watching on Peacock that Monday Night War documentary that the WWE Network did probably 10 years ago. And it's 20 episodes, and I've only cherry-picked maybe 3 or 4 episodes, because it's 20 episodes, but it could have easily been 8 to 10, because they repeat the same thing over and over and over again. The story isn't something that needed to be covered in 20 episodes. But I watched the Bret Hart episode because Bret Hart may be my favorite wrestler of all time. And in that episode, they go quite heavily into him signing the 20-year agreement with Vince. Vince not wanting to continue with the agreement. Him and Bret orchestrating Bret going to WCW. But then how Vince double-crossed him in Montreal, went against the finish that Bret had agreed upon. Creative control of his character was part of the agreement Bret had to come back. That was part of that 20-year contract. And it just reminded me that you never really had an agreement with Vince. You had a momentary business partnership that Vince was going to end at any time that he no longer felt that it was in his best interest. He had no intention of honoring any contracts long term if he didn't feel that they benefited him. He did it with Mike LaBelle in Los Angeles in the early 80s. He did it in St. Louis. The only one I never really blamed him for was backing out of the Calgary deal with Stu Hart, because Stu's son Bruce, right after Stu sells Vince the promotion, and I guess the video library, because Vince had the video library and all that, Stu's son Bruce, a few weeks later, starts another wrestling promotion and calls it Stampede Wrestling. So I can't really blame Vince for that one, because in Vince's mind, and I think most people would see it, the family, even though Stu wasn't involved, Bruce reneged on that deal and caused Vince to say, you know, why am I paying for this stuff? I'm really getting nothing out of it. That's the one I really couldn't blame him on. But Vince, routinely, the contracts he signs with the wrestlers now have 90-day out clauses. So they're 90-day contracts, which he can cancel at any time. He's in his current predicament now because he agreed to pay his victim $3 million for an NDA, and he only made one payment. So he didn't even pay her the money he had agreed upon, and I hope she gets a lot more than $3 million before this thing's all said with. He just made a ton of money selling the TKO stock, and I'm hoping a big portion of that ends up in her bank account. But you never really had a long-term deal with Vince. You had a short-term agreement that Vince would cancel anytime he felt it was no longer within his best interest. I think I'm going to jump into historical topic at this point. And I always say that whenever I'm doing these books and these research projects, I always learn new things or unlearn things I thought I knew. But in this one, I learned some new things. I had already written and had researched the match between Marin Plastina and John the Nebraska Tiger Man Pesek. But I knew a lot less about Plastina than I did Pesek. I knew Plastina had been trained for wrestling by Martin Farmer Burns. Tommy Burns was a boxer who got his clock cleaned by Jack Johnson. Martin Farmer Burns, who also was the trainer for Frank Gotch, had trained many of the best catch-as-catch-can hookers, meaning people skilled in submission holds or hooks, in the late 19th century, early 20th century. I just thought Plastina was a good hooker, but not on the level of Pesek and Stecker and Lewis, but someone who had enough skill that Curley was not willing to risk one of his top stars against Plastina, because if he did catch him with a hook, even though I thought the others were better, then it was a risk taking Plastina on. I have to reevaluate that. I thought Pesek was taking a much bigger risk wrestling Nat Pendleton a couple years later than he took in the Plastina match. And Pesek did have one advantage going into the Plastina match, is that Plastina, after 4 years of challenging the trust, when he finally got a match that could have led to wrestling one of the big four, he had a number of challenges going into that match, which we'll go into in the book, one of which was physical. Pesek was as at much risk when he wrestled Plastina of losing, if not more so than when he took on Pendleton. So if Nat Pendleton was a top of the food chain shooter, meaning almost nobody could wrestle as well as he could in a amateur Olympic, whether you call it folk style or freestyle, that style of wrestling without submissions. But it's hard to catch those guys in submissions. It can be done, but it's harder to catch those guys in submissions. Not many people were going to be able to stretch Jack Briscoe. And really, Stanislaw Sabisco fell into this same category. He learned submissions. He got okay with hooks. But he was always a far better Greco-Roman / freestyle straight wrestler than he was a hooker. But he was so good as a shooter that Ed Strangler Lewis thought he was one of only two people that could beat him in a legitimate contest. Where Pendleton is that top of the food chain shooter, Plastina is a top of the food chain hooker, meaning he is on the same level as Lewis, Stecker, and Pesek as a hooker. And I had no idea about that going into writing this project or doing this project, because I knew after Plastina lost the match with Pesek in 1921, he kind of fell in line, made peace with the trust, and he worked matches with all of those guys from then on. The whole problem with Plastina started during a legitimate contest between he and Joe Stecker. The match went 2 hours 20 minutes without a result, and the referee, based on his opinion that Stecker had the better of the match, which the match almost had no action in it, so I don't know how he would have come to this conclusion, he awarded the bout to Joe Stecker over Plastina. And that was September 1917. And it really ticked Plastina off, because he felt like he had got ripped off of the match. How could you award it to Stecker? And not only did they award it to Stecker, they didn't schedule a rematch. Maybe because the match would have probably been boring as all get out. So not long after that match with Stecker, Plastina starts. He and his manager, Joseph C. Marsh, who also was known as Ole Marsh, Ole, O-L-E, like Ole Anderson. Ole Marsh and Plastina spend the next 4 years challenging Curley in the Wrestling Trust. And they exposed the fact that Curley had the top four, which was Stecker, Earl Caddock, Ed Strangler Lewis and Vladek Zabisco that Curly was orchestrating who was winning those matches and that. He never inferred that the match between Caddock and Stecker in 1917 was a work, but he said subsequent matches between the Big Four had been works, and that Curly was controlling the title by having the wrestlers work with each other, and that Curly would not put them against anybody that he thought could beat them. Well, I don't think he thought anybody could beat Stecker, Caddock, or Lewis. Vladek Zabisco, I don't think, could beat Plastina. Because Zabisco could not beat Lewis. I'm not sure he ever wrestled Stecker in a legitimate contest. But Lewis and Vladek Zabisco hated each other legitimately for whatever reason. They just did not ping off each other. And they got in multiple fist fights. And I think later they worked some of them. But the initial ones, they just couldn't stand each other and started punching. And Vladek Zabisco, unfortunately, he will always be the other Zabisco. He was a good wrestler, but he wasn't on the level of his brother or the absolute top like Lewis and Stecker. And because of that, he is often kind of overlooked. But he was a really good wrestler, and he held the world title several times, but in legitimate contests, he wasn't going to beat any of those top guys. So that's why he always has kind of been the other Zabisco. There is a bit in The Fall Guys by Marcus Griffin about a contest that Zabisco talked himself into with Fred Grubmeier in New York. Grubmeier was an odd-looking guy, very tall, very thin and lanky, and didn't look like much. And a lot of people would, I mean, he didn't look like much to the point where he used to go rip off the carnival shows, because he would show up and the carnival owners would think, oh, look at this guy. He looks like a stork and he thinks he's going to beat my wrestler. And then Grubmeier, Grubby as they used to call him, would get in there and just destroy the carnival wrestler and take the carnival owner's money, which normally did not happen in those matches. If you had somebody who was good enough to beat the pro, and usually they beat them just wrestling, they didn't know hooks, and the pro couldn't, the carnival pro couldn't hook them, they'd get them up near the back canvas, and somebody would be on the other side of that canvas with a club and would club the contender who was trying to win the prize money, and then the pro would pin them. They did the exact same thing for the carnival boxing matches too. The we'll take on all comers. Because the carnival owners were not in the business of losing money and were con men at heart. Well, according to the Fall Guys, and realize you really need to double check all the information before you say, oh, this is true. Because a lot of it, there's lots of mistakes in there. It was written for revenge purposes. And so, and like many of the wrestling stories, they're more apocryphal than true anyway. But according to the Fall Guys and the personality of both of the people in between that are involved, this definitely could have happened. Vladek Zabisco takes one look at Grubmeier and basically says, why should I be losing to this stork? And Grubmeier says, well, we could just wrestle out there. And Grubmeier basically chewed him up for like 20 minutes. Didn't go against the finish. He didn't beat Zabisco, but he didn't let Zabisco beat him either. They wrestled a 20-minute draw. And they came back, and according to the book, Vladek Zabisco shakes his hand and apologizes and says, you're a great wrestler. And according to Marcus Griffin's book, Grubmeier said, no, I'm not a great wrestler, but then again, neither are you. So unfortunately for Vladek, he'll always be the other Zabisco. And based on what I saw in the research so far, I think Plastina could have definitely taken him. And Plastina would have been a threat to Stecker, Caddock, and Lewis. Although I think Lewis and Stecker probably could have beaten him. I mean, Plastina couldn't beat Stecker any more than Stecker beat him in their over 2-hour long stalemate. But Curly was not willing to risk it. So Curly, for 4 years, lets them basically expose his business in newspapers across the country, talking about how he controls the titles. They accurately predict title switches because they have inside information, either from Curly's office or from somewhere else, and they feed this information to a reporter who predicts correctly the world title switches. So they're exposing the work nature of pro wrestling, which is always detrimental. It's not catastrophic. It doesn't kill the promotion like they've talked about in the past. People still would come out and see it, but it normally did have a negative effect on the box office of some kind. And Curly is not going to, because professional wrestling then and now has always been about making money, Curly is not going to want them to expose his business and hurt his business. And World War I had already hurt professional wrestling anyway. It made Curly desperate enough for a payday that he agreed to let Vladek Zabisco wrestle John Pesek in Pesek's hometown of Nebraska in 1918. That's how desperate they were for a payday. It shows how concerned Curly was about the threat that Plastina posed. And I had not picked up on that prior to doing this research. So I'm hoping this book will show how threatening Plastina and Pendleton both were, and how significant it was that Pesek was able to turn back both of those challenges and end the promotional wars. Promotional wars hurt wrestling. The Monday Night Wars may have helped wrestling for a short time, but the end product hurt wrestling. There were millions of fans that when WCW went out of business, who never would... I eventually came around because of Bret Hart, who was a great wrestler, to appreciating some of what WWF / WWE was putting on. But it's still too sophomoric, soap opery, and all that. But you could find a few diamonds amongst the coal. But there were some NWA fans that never ever adapted to what WWF was selling. So when WCW was bought by WWF in 2001, I'm thinking 3 million, but I've heard some people say as high as 13 million. Fans just left and never came back to watch wrestling. And if you look at the number of people who were watching professional wrestling in 1980s in their individual territories, and the number of people who are watching it today, it's minuscule. The largest audience you have for WWF is probably 4 million people. The audience you have for AEW is 800,000 people. And you have crossovers within that 4 million and that 800,000. There seems to be some tribalism where the AEW fans can't like WWE and the WWE fans can't like AEW, but you can like both or neither. You know, you don't have to be loyal to one thing. I find both companies have some diamonds amongst a lot of coal. I find AEW a little more amateurish, and I find WWE a little more boring. But there are still good wrestlers in both. There are occasional good matches in both. Just, I don't know why anybody would watch a program. So, when I was a kid, if you didn't watch that program from the beginning to the end, you weren't going to see it again. Because shows weren't available on streaming. You thought you'd never going to be able to see that again. Even if you captured it on VHS. Okay, you'd be able to see that, but VHS came in the mid-80s. At least for us in St. Louis. I would never have thought to, well, I'm just going to, you know, save this on and skip through what I want. Today, you can watch any of those shows in about 20 minutes because you can just skip through all the junk that is junk and watch the one or two things that are in. when Vince was running WWE, I could go through 8 hours of programming in 30 minutes because there would be one match in all of that I would probably be interested in seeing. Plastina was able to make those challenges for 4 years. Curly's goal was obviously, I'm going to starve him out. I'm not going to give him any big matches, which he didn't. Plastina did maybe wrestle 10 times a year, which you could, a lot of the top guys, once the war was over, they could do that in a couple months. He was getting about 10 matches a year, but they were not big matches. He wrestled some decent names. Jess Westergaard, Charlie Cutler, who had been the American Heavyweight Wrestling Champion, Dr. Benjamin Roller. But these were all people who were kind of, they had held a title and they were past their prime, like Cutler and Roller. Roller was in his early 40s. And Westergaard, he was, him and Cutler were probably in their late 30s. But Plastina could not get to big matches with Caddick, Stecker, Lewis, or Sabisco, nor could he get booked regularly. He could only be booked by promoters who did not care about bucking Curly or were completely independent of the wrestling trust. I was shocked that they actually lasted 4 years before they finally forced Curly into a legitimate contest with Pesek, it turned out to be. He wanted the big four, but he settled for Pesek if beating Pesek meant he would get one of the big four finally. He would not have been able, and when I say he, too many pronouns as they like to say, Plastina would not have been able to hold out for those 4 years, he and Ollie Marsh, if it wasn't for the fact that they had backers. Well, we all know Tex Rickard signed Plastina to be his representative and to be his challenger in New York. But Plastina actually had a backer before that, and because Curly and his group of wrestlers refused to wrestle Plastina, Plastina claimed the world championship in 1919, and a lot of the newspapers recognized it because they said if these people who are supposedly fighting for the world title will not wrestle Marin Plastina, that must be because they're afraid of him. So Marin Plastina is obviously the best wrestler in the world. And he was giving legitimate credibility, even though he didn't beat any of the world champions. The closest he came was a draw with Stecker. The newspaper reporters and fans started recognizing him as a world champion because these other guys, and that happened in 1919. So you would have thought Curly would have in 1919 went, okay, we've got to do something about this. But it went another 2 years. And I think that if Curly had been able to starve him out, you would have never had that match with Pesek. But because he wasn't, he eventually had to agree to that match. Funny enough, in Pesek's next challenge, it was Curly who was sponsoring the wrestler. Curly was actually the one behind Nat Pendleton. And it was other wrestling promoters who were aligned this time and who put Pesek forth as their champion. So I'm hoping that I will have a lot more interesting tidbits for you as the research project continues. But Marin Plastina, you have my apologies. I did not realize how great a hooker you were and what a real threat you posed to the Wrestling Trust during that four-year period. I'm going to end the show with the review this week, and I'm going to put the link up in the show notes at kenzermanjr.com/episode51. I really encourage you to go and look at this clip. It's something I found in, I think it's in the library in South Carolina. They have a 7-minute video clip that they have put up online. And it is a 7-minute clip at Dick Schickett's training camp in the mid-1930s. And Joseph Tootsmott is his representative at the time, his manager. And so you'll see Mott, who looks to be in this like in his mid-40s. I'm thinking this is mid to late 30s. Could be early 30s. But it's somewhere in the 30s. Because they're recognizing Schickett as the world champion. And one of the interesting things about this is this could be before Schickett turned on them. But, no, I think it would have to be after, because I don't think Schickett was the world champion until after he double-crossed O'Mahony. But it's somewhere in the 30s. Dick Schickett got furious at the Mott and Lewis and double-crossed the promoters in 1934-1935 with Dan O'Mahony. Could have been 36, because of something that happened with him, Lewis, and Tootsmott. And Tootsmott was Lewis's training partner, and they had agreed to for Lewis to lose the title to Schickett. But something happened between that time and when Lewis was supposed to drop it to Schickett, and Lewis ended up dropping it to somebody else. And whoever else that he dropped it to, that really infuriated Dick Schickett, because he had paid a deposit. The world champion used to pay a deposit to get the belt, and that deposit basically guaranteed that they would go along with what the promoters wanted, because if they didn't, they didn't get the deposit back. And it was always a significant amount of money. I think it was $5,000 or $10,000 when Schickett paid it. I know a couple times Lewis had to put up $25,000. Because they figured $25,000 was enough of a deterrent to keep Lewis from going into business for himself. Because Lewis could beat anybody he wanted. So they made him put up a sizable guarantee, figuring that he wouldn't want to forfeit $25,000 if he decided to keep the belt when it was time to drop it. Lewis, because it was Lewis, Mott would have just kept it. But I believe Lewis returned Schickett's money. But Schickett was still mad and confronted Lewis in a hotel room in somewhere in New York. And they had heated words, and Schickett punches Lewis. Lewis punches Schickett. And they have a general punch-up. And that would have been the end of it, because Lewis was not one to hold a grudge that long, and he respected Schickett. And they had had their say and had their little punch up. Unfortunately, Tootsmott, who was there, decided to jump in towards the end, and he really gave Schickett quite a thrashing, really beat him up pretty bad. And Schickett never forgot that. He was very angry about it, because he felt like he and Lewis were settling things, and then Mott back jumps him and really hurts him when he's defenseless because he's engaged with Lewis. So you have the beating in the hotel room, and then Paul Bowser convinces the trust to put the belt on Dan O'Mahony, somebody Schickett can't stand and has no respect for. So Schickett decides to shoot on him and take his world title legitimately, and then went to work for another promoter. This is either after that, and I think it's after it, because Tootsmott looks to be in his early to mid-40s. But it could be before, but I'm almost, let me say this, I'm 99% positive it was after everything that I've just talked about here. So it shows you that even though these guys had a long-standing animosity to the point that Schickett shot on Dan O'Mahony and took his world championship, that if the money was right and the conditions were right, these guys would bury the hatchet and start working together and be partners again. And not only does Mott represent Schickett and is his manager, when you look at this training camp footage, I believe Tootsmott is in there wrestling with him and really gives Schickett a pretty good workout. Both of these guys were shooters and hookers, Schickett and Mott, although Mott's getting up in age. because a couple of the guys, you can tell Schickett's just playing with him, but one guy really gives him a go, and I think that is Toots Mont that's in there giving him the go. So check it out, if nothing more, for the historical interest of seeing both Schickett and Mont in their relative, well, Schickett in his prime. Mont, I don't know that there's very much video footage of him out there, so this is just a chance to see Toots Mont from video footage in the 1930s. So with that, I'm going to end this episode. If you enjoyed It Was Almost Real, please rate us wherever you listen to the podcast at. And if you're a fan of YouTube and prefer to listen on there, I think that that is our next project, is to get the podcast up on YouTube and to publish each new episode, not only through the podcast apps, but also to post it on YouTube. So we'll give you an update when we get that taken care of. But until next time, take care, everybody. Bye-bye.